You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to episode 13 of Commentary, Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm Max.
And today we are joined by my Uncle Tony. How's it going?
It's great. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, thanks for joining us. Now, Uncle Tony, you're a librarian by day, but a Sherlock Holmes fan by night.
I am a Sherlock Holmes fan.
But only at night.
Well, you know, during the course of my professional life, of course, I've had the opportunity to recommend Reader's Advisory, some people on to Holmes. Holmes is one of my passions. Yes, I like Sherlock Holmes. Have since I was 13 years old.
Okay, but before we get started on Sherlock Holmes, I guess.
Yes.
Just so that people know, since this is a Star Trek show.
Oh, yes. Okay.
What is your relationship with Star Trek?
I have never been a big science fiction guy. I appreciate the interest in the genre. Is it something that I spend a lot of time with on a personal level? Probably not.
Well, yeah, I mean, I can't remember a single time you've ever watched Star Trek, as far as I can recall.
Well, I do remember, now you can probably correct me as to my dates and my memory, but I do recall going to see The Wrath of Khan.
There you go, 1982. So you would
1982,
have been,
there you go. Yeah. That was the year I graduated from college. So I do have that memory.
Well, that's a good. Well, what I don't know if you remember, since it was 31 years ago. But what did you think
Thanks
of
for
the
me
Wrath
about
of Khan?
The distance on that. Yeah. What do 31. I remember about the Wrath of Khan? I don't have any negative thoughts about it. I don't know that I have
that's
many,
a good place to start.
Many thoughts at all. I think I was pleasantly entertained, from what I can recall.
Okay.
It was fun.
Okay. Well, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan is kind of like the perfect entryway into this series, since that's the one which was directed by Nicholas Meyer and ghostwritten by him as well.
Okay.
My earliest memories of Sherlock Holmes were really,
Hat and Pot based?
In a sense, you know, watching the show that was on Mystery and what have you. And I remember, you know, watching that show with you. And
Jeremy Brett?
Yeah, you were a pretty big fan of that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. To date, I think it's still the gold standard for film capturing of Conan Doyle's character.
So now I remember, when I first found out that Nicholas Meyer had written the 7% solution, you know, I was kind of fascinated by that idea, and I mentioned it to you, since I knew that you were a big fan of the canon at the very least, and you told me like, oh yeah, he did. Not only that, but he wrote this other book, West End Horror, here they are. And then you actually gave me, you know, the two books, which was pretty cool, which I've finally gotten around to reading now. What did you think about the 7% solution?
In the Holmesian world, they call what Myers did and what others do pastiches, I think. But Nicholas Meyer was probably the first of the non-Conan Doyle people that I read dealing with Sherlock Holmes stories. I read the canon when I was 14. I received a copy, a one-volume edition. Christopher Morley was the editor. And I remember just tearing through that. Probably within the span of a year, I had read the entire canon. Of course, you know, your hunger is always for more and more and more because you...
Yeah.
So I'm not really sure how I remember getting turned on to Nicholas Meyer. I have a vague recollection that one of my friends in college, who was also heavily into Sherlock Holmes, mentioned that, hey, there's this book, The 7% Solution, and, you know, you should read it. And, of course, I did and liked it so much that I read the other two Nicholas Meyer creations. And I've read a lot of these pastiches, you know, since. And in my mind, Meyer's work, in terms of the pastiches, is still kind of the standard or the bar for Sherlock Holmes type stories. They've kind of stood the test of time, and I think that's an indication as to how closely they've captured the Conan Doyle character.
I didn't even know that he did anything other than 7% Solution mm-hmm. until you handed me the West End Horror, but obviously he did, and that's the book that we're covering tonight, which he wrote in 1976, which was 2 years after 7% Solution right. came out. As far as just a brief synopsis of this book, it's basically Holmes in a mystery involving the British theater scene right. at the time.
Right.
Would you, Max? You want to?
Well, the first book, The 7% Solution, is very much like Holmes goes into rehab. Mm-hmm. Also, someone gets murdered.
Yeah,
and this one is more like someone gets murdered in right. the British theater scene.
Right.
And Oscar Wilde is there, and Gilbert and Sullivan are there, and some other people who you might know the names of get involved.
Well, Shaw has a pretty big role.
Yeah.
He does, but not like in his capacity as George Bernard Shaw.
No.
More in his capacity as a guy who lives in London.
Right.
And as a critic.
Yes, that's true. As a critic, yeah. The critic, which is sort of, I think most people who know George Bernard Shaw now
right.
don't really know that he
playwright.
Was more famous for being a critic than
right.
than anything else. But yes, I mean, I know Pygmalion, but I don't know what he said about Gilbert and Sullivan.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Nobody's publishing those.
I think that's what's interesting in the West End Horror is that you see some of these literary figures, which everybody has name recognition of.
Yes.
You may not know a lot about their work necessarily, but you know, George Bernard Shaw, I've heard of him. I've heard of Bram Stoker and Dracula, right? And then I've heard of Oscar Wilde. And so it's kind of interesting to see these characters that we all have probably a name recognition for described in a light that kind of shed some background on their you know what
yeah
who they actually were, you know. George Bernard Shaw as critic. If somebody came up to me and said, "Who is George Bernard Shaw?" I would have said, "Well, he's a playwright."
Yeah,
you know?
He wrote that Pygmalion
right,
thing.
Right,
but you might know him from the movie. But
the knowledge of him being a well-known literary critic,
yeah,
that wouldn't be something that would come to mind. So I
apparently he also had a different name for those.
Oh, yes, that's right. Yeah, he wrote under another, a pseudonym.
So that's probably part of it.
Yes.
Part of it is that, GBS is associated with plays.
Right.
And whatever the other name is,
right.
I forget,
right.
is not.
Right.
So that's probably part of it. Probably intentional. Probably he was probably shaping his own legacy.
I think a lot of literary, especially early literary figures, when we think of them, did that. Just to see how their work would be received in the absence of knowledge of who they were.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I it certainly has been a something that many, many authors have done. George Eliot, Silas Marner. George Eliot was a woman.
Yes.
Used the man's name because, when she was writing, the thought of a woman author, women didn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Well, and there's precedent for that in Star Trek.
Yeah. D.C. Fontana, who was a very big member of the writing staff.
Who was also female.
Yeah, her name.
Really?
Dorothy Fontana. She used the
so even
name
this
DC
modern
Fontana to.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But I mean, Star Trek depicted a future, but the producers
were very much stuck in the.
Some of the producers were stuck, some of them weren't, but the studio and the network people.
Yeah.
Okay. They were pretty, no, that's crazy.
Yeah.
There would not be an equal amount of women.
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Very interesting.
I mean, there's nobody needs that many secretaries.
So, in terms of like the just basic specifics of the plot, the George Bernard Shaw, who's apparently friendly with Holmes, hires Holmes to investigate the murder of another critic, and this leads to a larger mystery involving the British theater scene, the West End theater scene,
because there's essentially no clues.
Right,
like the crime scene reveals like almost nothing about the actual incident. So like a big chunk of the book is trying to figure out where to investigate.
Right. Yeah.
Which is sort of unusual for Holmes because usually it's a short story and it's like 9 pages, and in the first page you're like, it's that guy with the weird hat, but I don't know why.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Right. This is more akin to probably one of the novels, so to speak.
Hound of the Baskervilles.
Hound of the Baskervilles, Study in Scarlet, Sign of the Four. It's not that neat little package of, you know.
But even A Study in Scarlet starts off like clues.
Right, right.
And then they're really weird long departures.
Yeah.
But they mean something.
I think one of the things that I found about the West End horror is in the absence of knowledge, if a total novice had picked this book up and started to read it, it would be somewhat difficult if you didn't have some rudimentary knowledge of English theater. If you didn't know George Bernard Shaw, if you didn't know Gilbert and Sullivan,
was actually the thing. Gilbert and Sullivan, it's the ones I knew least about.
Yeah, I mean, this book was very edifying in terms of their relationship. Much different than what my preconceived thought about.
I've always imagined they were like the Coen brothers, but with singing and dancing.
Right.
Turns out they weren't.
No. And so that was very enlightening. So
unless they are.
Yeah. So I think Meyer does a really good job of introducing people to, you know, late 19th century British theater. And when you think about it, what a creative time that was in British theater, English theater.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, the giants of the stage, you know, Oscar Wilde, you know, Gilbert and Sullivan, you know, these are all contemporaries.
It's kind of amazing to imagine that, like, throughout the London's history, there have been many periods where, like, you know, 13 different super famous people from history all knew each other. And some of them didn't like each other.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
I had to get a kick. I got a kick out of here when I think it was Shaw's character who was very dismissive of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that kind of the godfather of.
Well, personally, I feel that was Nicholas Meyer saying, I know what you guys are going to say about this book. Mm-hmm. I'm going to have George Bernard Shaw say it so that you feel stupid for even trying to say a better argument than him. Because he's saying that about Shakespeare.
Right.
Seriously, you're going to criticize me for this. Shakespeare did the same thing. Deal with it, suckers. Yeah. And then he moved on with the plot.
But certainly, even if you did not have a knowledge, I think, in this book of English theater of that particular era, you could still learn a lot from what Meyer, the background that he provides.
It's not crucial.
No, it's not crucial.
Like, you don't need to know that Gilbert and Sullivan are still popular.
No.
All you need to know is that they were.
They were.
Even then.
Right. So I think it's a book that, you know, someone who picks up, and this is the first home story they may have ever read, they'll find that enjoyable, and someone who has broad knowledge would find it enjoyable.
Yeah.
You know, I think a writer always, when he's writing for a wide audience, you know, it's a real trick to capture the interest of both people who are, I call them foamers, you know, people who are passionate or know every nuance about a particular subject. It's very difficult to get that crowd interested and also the, you know, the general reading.
Well, then he was very prepared for Star Trek, because that's pretty much the entire thing.
Right. I would say that's,
yeah.
You know, a novice like me could enjoy something like The Wrath of Khan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, Trekkies.
Yeah. Could. That's part of why, like, I think a lot of the time during these episodes, we've sort of come back to, you know, his stuff is great. Everyone in the Star Trek community, everyone's a huge fan, loves his work. Also, we try to use it to break people in.
Yeah, usually, like, if someone says, like, I've never seen Star Trek before, what should I watch? You know, one of the inevitable go-tos is Wrath of Khan, you know?
I think that's very interesting, you know?
Yeah.
The Sherlockians, you know, you don't think about that group in the same setting as you do Star Trek people and Star Wars people. And
I do.
Yeah, I mean,
I totally stereotype.
Right,
them.
But but boy, I mean, talk about people who get incensed or you guys probably heard of the Baker Street Irregulars.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which I read Nicholas Meyer after, mm-hmm. I think.
He dedicates, I think, the book to the Baker Street Irregulars.
Does he? Yeah. He was inducted into their ranks.
But he, I mean, when you start writing and you know that there's this group out there that, you know, they know what Holmes had for lunch on a certain day in a certain place, you know, the ability to gain their respect and acceptance as well as the general reader, the uninitiated, that's a hard trick to pull off.
Can you describe what they are just for...
Yeah, well, the Baker Street Irregulars, how would I describe them? a fan club on steroids, maybe, you know, in terms of their devotion, their passion. Different. There are different chapters of the Bakersfield Irregulars, probably too numerous to even name. And many of the chapters have activities, you know, where they will gather on Holmes's birthday and have a dinner, and the people will dress from the period, and they will have quizzes on Sherlockian knowledge. And at one point, I used to subscribe to, and I'm not sure if it still exists, but I used to get the Baker Street Journal, and it was basically a collection of academic essays that were sent in by amateurs and professionals alike, and they would parse every little detail about the Holmes stories.
And did somebody ever get around to writing some of those things that Holmes apparently wrote, like the tobacco ash stuff?
Yes.
I want to read them.
I mean, and you know, I think it actually all started in New York, and I want to say it started sometime in the 1930s or 40s. But you know, they are people that have just found their passion in the world of the 1880s London and Sherlock Holmes, and those people are probably as passionate as the people that you see going to Star Trek conventions and Star Wars conventions. There's really no, you know, it's just that they have found something that they really enjoy, they really relate to. I think it's all meant in good fun. Some people take it too seriously, of course, you know, go a little bit over the top.
I don't see how that's possible.
Well, you know, you have to keep...
Don't explain.
Okay, yes, okay, all right.
As far as the book itself is concerned, what Uncle Tony, what are your thoughts just on the whole, like as a book? Like,
very easy to read. I think for someone who maybe has not been exposed to the canon, it would be a very gentle way of being introduced to Holmes and getting the flavor of what he's about and Watson. You don't have to have a lot of background knowledge at all about the setting or the character. It's a standalone, which oftentimes is a problem with recurring characters. If you don't start at the beginning, you've lost the whole, you know. I think an uninitiated person to Holmes could pick this up and say, oh, that was a really good mystery. You know, it made sense. The characters were well-developed. I kind of have an understanding of this guy Holmes and his friend Watson and in that particular era in London. I think Meyer did a really nice job of
there are references to previous events, though.
Oh, sure there
are. They all have those little footnotes that are very very succinct. It's like when did he meet Dr. Agar? I don't remember that happening. Yeah. And it's like, oh, and that one. And I'm like, oh yeah, I kind of remember that.
I think it's really interesting the footnotes that he has, you know, and he keeps referring to Baring Gould, William Baring Gould, who is kind of the great grandfather of the Sherlockian experts. William Baring Gould wrote a 2-volume annotated anthology of Sherlock Holmes. Baring Gould took the Holmes canon and any reference to a place, a historical figure, a historical happening, he annotated it and footnoted it so that you could read The Sign of the Four or Study in Scarlet. And, you know, in Study in Scarlet, where Holmes and Watson meet for the first time.
Yeah.
Baring Gould will take the hospital laboratory that they met in and will say, you know, this is St. Bartholomew's Hospital. Don't quote me on St. Bartholomew, but somehow that sticks in my mind. And it existed from, you know, 18-something to 18, and it was noted for blah, 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 blah. And so he fills in all the background that maybe someone not knowledgeable about that time, that place, you feel like you know what he's talking about. It would be like saying Oak Park Hospital. Well, I know where Oak Park Hospital is. I know where it's situated. I know what it looks like. I know.
Yeah.
And but Baring Gould just takes this for every reference And
so if you entered his office while he was writing this and you saw everything on the walls and all the pins on the map, you would assume that he was tracking some sort of extremely dangerous terrorist.
I mean, Barry Goldnow is the probably the best example of someone who I would call a foamer. You know, I referred to that before. But in a very academic way, you know. I mean, he takes every part of that canon. And that's what Holmesian people like, and that's what, like, I'm assuming Star Trek people like.
The Star Trek version of that would be Mike Okuda. And he is also sort of like the unofficial or sometimes official historian of Star Trek. He's written a chronology, an encyclopedia. Mm-hmm. He's done tons of stuff like this.
Meyer did a great job here of writing for both an uninitiated audience and a Fulmer audience, and making an entertaining story and a believable character for both of those extremes.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do. It's hard to satisfy that Fulmer crowd, especially. My sense is just the mere fact that, you know, he is able to dedicate this book to the Baker Street Irregulars and then be inducted into a Baker Street Irregular society. That's pretty much a testament to his research, I think, and his, being faithful.
Oh, yeah.
He's faithful. You know, he doesn't...
He is.
He doesn't take someone else's character and make him his own. You know, too many authors want to do that. They want to take a character who already exists and put their own spin on, and to his credit, I think Meyer doesn't do that. You know,
that's actually one of the exceptional things that Meyer seems capable of, that... And most people, even if they were trying not to, they would inevitably rub off on the character. And he seems able to read or absorb the source material and then somehow get it in a way that most people would require years
to get. I would agree with you totally. And I think that's got to be very hard. It's almost like the lack of an ego in terms of projecting your own. You know, you're taking this character, and you are just putting him in a different situation.
I mean, the astonishing thing is that, like, he did that with Sherlock Holmes, and then amazingly enough, he did it with Star Trek and Captain Kirk, and somehow he managed to actually look at the material and not project any of himself into those characters, and then, like, actually see things in them that were there.
And the interesting difference between those two is where he was, like, a huge Sherlock Holmes fan, he had basically never seen Star Trek before getting that job.
Which means, like, his mutant power might have been formed while researching Sherlock Holmes, but it's not exclusive to it.
Mm-hmm.
So he can turn that on something else. Yeah. And, I mean, maybe it's Disney will hire him for Star Wars, and we'll be spared a lot of nonsense.
I mean, I think that's a rare... That's a rare quality in an author. I've read a million non-Sherlockian books that pretend to be sequels to another famous book, and you're always kind of left, or at least I'm kind of left feeling, well, that doesn't seem like Ian Fleming's character, you know, that doesn't seem like Bond, you know, that's not. With Byers books, my impression is, I think Conan Doyle would have been happy with the portrayal. Now you have one, Holmes on the Range, you know, where Holmes is like a cowboy character.
That's not real. You made that up.
I wish I had. but my impression is it's gotten easier to write. Maybe a case where it's been in the public domain now for, I'm not sure. But certainly you see a lot more of these than I remember as a youth, you know, maybe in the 70s and 80s. Just, you know, you can go to any bookstore, you can go on Amazon, the Barnes & Noble website, put in keywords Sherlock Holmes, and you'll find tons of things, you know, and not always of the best quality.
Oh, yeah. I think that it's perfectly reasonable that he was also a vampire hunter.
Oh, well, well, Holmes, you know.
If anyone could be a vampire hunter at night while being a well-employed detective during the day, it would be, you know, robot Sherlock Holmes.
There are Holmes books, Holmes for the Holiday.
That's not real. You meant that.
Collection of short stories, Holmes at Christmas.
No.
I mean, really? My impression is that Holmes was not overly concerned with
You're making this up. That's not real.
Christmas. You know? I mean, he didn't impress me as the.
Don't show me any evidence of this.
Well,
I don't want you to prove your point.
I have gotten rid of most of those and sent them on to a better home.
Home saves Santa.
Well, Max, what did you think about the book on the whole?
I read the 7% Solution and I enjoyed it, despite being dramatically kind of wonky. Mm-hmm. It kind of limps along until it concludes. This one has a much more solid story. Yeah. It has it's more encapsulated. There's kind of like a bubble. It's like it starts on one side, and in the middle of it, there's a whole bunch of London. Like you more or less just sort of traveling around London, like hey, let's go over there. That's cool. And this guy's funny, and that guy's weird, and Oscar Wilde, yes, he is just as odd as you would imagine. And then they get to the conclusion, and it's like oh yeah, the mystery.
Yeah, I pretty much agreed with Max's assessment. You know, I mean, I do think it is a stronger story on the whole as 7% than 7% Solution. But I think like what 7% Solution does is interesting in that it sort of fixes problems with the continuity, whereas this one just tells a really good story. Like in a sense, I kind of wish they were flipped and this one would have been first, but. Because it's a 7% Solution, he's like, there's something that I want to do with this, know? Whereas with this one, he's like, I just want to tell a story, which is fine.
But interestingly enough, since I heard about the Western Horror, I had been told by somebody, and I thought for a very long time that Jack the Ripper was in it.
Yeah.
Because it sounds exactly like Jack the Ripper.
You would think,
But Jack the Ripper's the East End Horror.
Oh, obviously. Yes.
Yes, the Whitechapel thing is on the East End. The theater district is on the West End.
Okay. Right, so these guys are West Side, those guys are East
but
Side.
But I wonder how many people did pick up this book.
Thinking that it was
Jack the Ripper. Yeah, I mean, this story, it's a good standalone. I'd have no problem recommending it to a person who would come into the library and say, "Hey, I've read the whole Sherlock Holmes canon.
Yeah.
I really love this guy. I'm looking for more about him."
That's a question that I want to get to with every time we talk about something like this.
Yeah.
It's could you put this in the canon comfortably? And I would say it almost doesn't matter. Because you can add it there, and it doesn't screw anything up. As a puzzle piece, it's a very small puzzle piece.
Yeah.
But it's also really good. There it is. I put it in there.
It's good, and I think you mentioned it before, Max. The only thing that I would hesitate is the writing style is different.
It is.
But to his credit, he doesn't try to mimic Conan Doyle's cadence and his.
That would not be a good idea.
Most people won't succeed when they do that.
Well, no, I think it's actually technically impossible.
So right, and he's. You got to be true to yourself as an author, and the most you can hope for, I think, is to be true to the character.
Right. So the dialogue has to ring true. It has to be appropriate dialogue.
Right.
He can't start dropping ain'ts in there.
I really think it would be very hard if you start writing in that late 19th century prose.
Yeah.
You're going to confine yourself to just the Sherlockian part of the.
That's another thing that John was talking about was fights with the publisher over how far he could go,
Publishers love Sherlock Holmes.
Yeah.
But they don't necessarily want
the
writer to be writing for that 1880s audience,
I've read almost everything Conan Doyle has written and Sherlock Holmes is probably the most readable.
Oh yeah.
Because if you read The Lost World, that book is unreadable.
Yeah.
There are five pages straight of listings.
Conan Doyle was we've talked only about Sherlock Holmes,
He was an old-timey writer.
Yes.
He was a writer that wrote by gaslight.
Yes.
That is not a writing style that we should approach these days because we have TV and video games and iPods and iPads and just way too many channels with great entertainment. Check out ABC.
And too many options.
Yes.
When Conan Doyle was writing, he's writing, people, The Strand Magazine, right? Okay, mm-hmm. So you have people that would wait for weeks, for the next issue of The Strand Magazine to come. They'd flood the newsstand and sell out the newsstand.
Yeah,
they were starved for...
Because your entertainment was The Strand Magazine, Gilbert and Sullivan Plays, and The Strand Magazine.
Meyer took this character, brought him into the 20th century, captured the essence and flavor, I think, of the character... In a way that satisfies the traditionalists and could possibly create interest for newcomers, which I think is really a great thing. You know, I mean, I wonder how many people saw this, read this, said, oh, I'm really interested in learning more about, you know, the real Holmes, you know, the Conan Doyle Holmes. I always have a favorable impression of someone who, an author who will create interest in the reader to the point where they want to go back to the original or the basis, you know, and learn more. You know, he did the Holmesian world a service with this, I think.
And any final thoughts? Or
I recommend that you watch The Wrath of Khan, because then you're going to be like, whoa, where did that guy first appear? And then you watch Space Seed, and you'll be like, this original series has the worst production design I've ever seen. I'm not watching this ever again. Is there anything else that's good? And we'll say Next Generation, and then you'll watch that.
Okay, all right. So you're going to go back to The Wrath of Khan and rewatch that?
That's an imperative statement. You have to do that now.
Okay, I have to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. And also, like John pointed out last episode, Star Trek VI, which is the other one that Meyer did, is very much a Sherlock Holmes type of mystery with
Although,
Spock as Holmes.
There's no red herrings. No. Well, there's one.
Yeah, one.
All right. It would be interesting, I think. And I'm sure this stuff now is much more readily available. But to see what the Baker Street Irregular Journal has said about, I'm sure his work has been parsed by academics and by Sherlockian scholars. And I think it would be very interesting to go and read what they have to say. If I was a betting man, I would say their commentary would be favorable.
Yeah, you know? I imagine so too.
I think he's pretty careful with his details, you know, and I think as he's as good as anyone who's tried their hands at recreating the character.
All right. Well, Uncle Tony, have you got anything that you want to promote or anything? Or
no, I would just say, you know, for all you Sherlockians out there or want to be Sherlockians or anyone interested in Sherlock Holmes, visit your local public library. It's a PSA here. And talk to your friendly Reader's Advisory Librarian. And if we don't know specifically about what you're asking for, we know how to find it. So I thank you for the opportunity to talk about Sherlock. I always enjoy talking about my passions and my interests. So.
Oh, yeah. Well, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, this was very fun.
Yeah, you guys were great.
And thanks for giving me those books, too, so that I could
hang on to them. They might be worth something on eBay.
As always, you can find us at our other show on commentarytrackstars.com, or you can find us, you can email us at comtrackstars@gmail.com, or find us on Twitter at comtrackstars, or you can check out this show on trek.fm in addition to a million other shows, all of which are probably better than ours. So next week, tune in for part 5 of our Nicholas Meyer series, where we will be looking at The Black Orchid, joined by Matt from Literary Treks.
Yes.